Welcome back to the Deep Dive. So for years, the main story around the West sanctions on Russia has been, well, pretty consistent, hasn't it? Unprecedented action, aggressive economic isolation. You know the drill.
Absolutely. It's been framed as this historic effort.
But what if we actually look past that political talk? What does the raw data tell us nearly 4 years on?
That's where things get complicated.
And that's exactly our mission today. We're digging into some sources that, frankly, paint a really provocative picture. They argue these sanctions haven't just failed to hit their main targets, but maybe, just maybe, they've backfired, possibly speeding up Europe's deindustrialization and, kind of ironically, boosting U.S. energy dominance.
It's a really critical point to make right at the start. I mean, 19 EU sanctions packages, thousands of names on lists. The scale is huge.
Right. It feels massive.
It feels like it must be working because there's so much of it. But we really need to focus on the economic reality. Are these measures actually changing Russia's behavior? Are they hitting the revenue streams they were supposed to hit?
Or is it more like political signaling?
Exactly. Are we seeing strategic coercion or is it just, you know, political theater?
Okay, let's unpack that. The first big issue these reports highlight is how Russia is keeping the money flowing despite that G7 price cap, the one designed specifically to cut off their oil cash.
Yes, and this involves something called the Shadow Fleet.
The Shadow Fleet. All right. Tell us about that.
Well, what's really striking is how fast Russia put this together. It's essentially a network, an armada, really, of tankers, often older ships operated with murky ownership structures, and crucially, outside the usual Western insurance and regulatory systems. This lets them completely bypass the G7's $60 a barrel price ceiling.
Wait, so they set up this whole parallel system?
Pretty much. And it seems to be working for them. There's research from the Brookings Institution suggesting this shadow infrastructure generated something like an extra $9.4 billion for Russia in 2024.
$9.4 billion just in 1 year.
Yes, specifically because their oil exports were consistently selling above that $60 cap.
So the cap didn't really cap the price.
It seems it didn't stop the oil flow or depress the price much.
Sure.
It just, well, it pushed the deals into these less transparent, unregulated channels, places where Western oversight just doesn't reach.
Wow. That figure, $9.4 billion, that's really something. But it's not just crude oil, is it? The goal was broader cut Russia out of the energy market. How are Europeans potentially still paying for Russian oil, even if indirectly?
Ah, yes. This brings us to the refined product loop.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where it gets particularly interesting in terms of unintended consequences.
How does that work?
Well, Europe sanctioned refined Russian products, like diesel and gasoline, right? So European buyers couldn't buy directly from Russia anymore.
Okay.
So now they buy those refined products from places like India and Turkey. But here's the twist. These countries often import Russian crude oil first, usually to discount refine it themselves.
And then sell it back to Europe.
Exactly. They sell it back to Europe, but at a significant markup.
So Europe ends up paying more.
Considerably more, according to these sources. The data is quite stark. In early 2025, just looking at India, the EU and Turkey imported out 2.4 million tons of refined products. Right. And the sources suggest that maybe two-thirds of that volume actually originated from Russian crude oil.
Two-thirds. So the bottom line is Europe pays a premium for oil that still started out in Russia, and Moscow keeps making money through these other routes.
That seems to be the mechanism, yes. Europe pays more. Russia maintains revenue via these key partners in Asia. The sanctions change the route, not necessarily the source or the revenue flow for Moscow.
Okay, so if Russia found ways around the financial restrictions, who's actually bearing the brunt of the economic cost here? The sources we looked at point pretty clearly back towards Europe.
Yes, the economic pain seems to have shifted significantly, and a huge part of that starts with natural gas. The shift in Europe's supply has been dramatic.
How dramatic?
Well, think about this. Before 2022, Russia supplied nearly half, 48% of the EU's natural gas.
Almost half. Wow.
Today, that figure is down to around 12%.
Huh.
A massive drop.
So where did Europe get the gas to fill that enormous gap?
That's the crucial part. The replacement was largely American liquefied natural gas, LNG, which is considerably more expensive.
More expensive.
Yes. And U.S. LNG now makes up nearly half of the EU's total LNG imports, which themselves have increased substantially.
So they swapped cheaper Russian pipeline gas for pricier American LNG.
And it's not just a short-term fix. Many European countries and major utility companies locked themselves into long-term contracts to secure this U.S. LNG supply, often at premium prices.
Long-term premium contracts. That sounds like it would have knock-on effects for industry.
Absolutely. It created immediate and, more importantly, structural challenges for European industrial competitiveness on the global stage.
And you can't really talk about European industry without focusing on Germany, right? The report suggests Germany, in particular, paid a heavy price.
Germany's situation really highlights this potential self-inflicted wound aspect. The country lost around 125,000 industrial jobs recently.
125,000 jobs.
That's huge. It is. And it's not just a number. That represents entire supply chains, communities. It seems to reflect years of facing these much higher energy costs.
Because they switched energy sources.
Right. And those high costs mean energy-intensive industries, think specialized chemicals, metallurgy, things Germany excels at, are facing serious structural decline. They simply can't compete with rivals, particularly in Asia, who don't have those same energy cost burdens.
So the economic consequences are significant, but there's another angle here. Moving away from pure economics, what about the impact on, well, on legal principles, on the courts?
This is a really crucial, though maybe less discussed, consequence. The sources raise serious questions about the erosion of judicial oversight, all in the name of enforcing these sanctions effectively.
How so? What's the mechanism?
One key concept that comes up is the idea of cumulative effect. It's being used, apparently, as a kind of catch-all justification for freezing assets.
Cumulative effect. Explain that a bit.
Okay, take the case of Eugene Schindler. His assets were frozen, quite significant assets.
Yeah.
But the justification wasn't necessarily proven illegal activity on his part.
No. Then what was it?
It was cited as being due to his historical business associations with Roman Abramovich.
Hmm.
The argument, essentially, is the government doesn't have to prove that sanctioning this specific person directly achieves a foreign policy goal.
Right.
They just need to argue that adding their name to the list contributes to the overall pressure being put on the target state. It's a part of the pile-on effect.
That sounds like, well, it sounds like it lowers the bar quite a bit for taking someone's assets.
Yeah.
What did the courts make of that standard?
Well, the UK Supreme Court actually accepted this reasoning. They agreed that sanctions only need to contribute to this general cumulative pressure, even if you can't demonstrate that this specific action will achieve a concrete policy outcome. But there was a strong dissent. Lord Leggett warned that this approach basically means courts are giving up on meaningful judicial oversight. It potentially gives the executive branch huge, almost unchecked power when it claims national security goals.
Unchecked power. And is there another example of this kind of lack of scrutiny?
Yes, the seizure of the superyacht Fi is probably the most high-profile case illustrating this judicial reluctance.
The Fi yacht, right. What happened there?
It's quite remarkable. The Court of Appeal actually found that some public statements made by the Transport Secretary at the time, Grant Shapps, about the reasons for seizing the yacht were inaccurate or even misleading.
They found the government's claims were inaccurate.
Yes. But despite finding fault with the executive's public justification, both the initial court and the Court of Appeal upheld the yacht's detention.
Even though the justification was flawed.
Correct. And what's more, the court stated they were wholly unqualified to really dig into and scrutinize the decisions made by the executive branch regarding sanctions.
Unqualified to review decisions they're constitutionally supposed to review.
Precisely. And that's where you see this potential shift in the balance of power. If courts step back like this, it arguably gives the executive a free hand to impose major economic sanctions without the usual checks and balances.
Okay, so let's pivot back to the strategic level, the bigger picture. If Europe took the economic hit and Russia managed to maintain its revenue streams, who actually came out ahead strategically from this massive global reshuffle?
Looking at the sources we reviewed, the consensus is pretty clear. The United States secured a major strategic win.
How so?
By replacing Russia as Europe's primary energy supplier, particularly with LNG. Europe's dependence shifted from Russian pipelines to American tankers, potentially for decades.
Decades.
Well, projections, for instance, from ExxonMobil suggest the U.S. could end up supplying nearly three-quarters of all of Europe's LNG imports in the coming years.
Three-quarters. Wow.
And this isn't just hypothetical. We're seeing it locked in with those long-term premium-priced contracts we mentioned earlier. Italy's Eni signed a massive 20-year deal with Venture Global.
20 years?
Yeah. And German utilities like Safe, Edison, they've done similar long-term deals. The U.S. essentially became the guaranteed, highly profitable energy provider for a massive, and at that point, quite desperate European market.
So a huge win for U.S. commercial and strategic interests. But Russia wasn't just passively adapting with its shadow fleet, right? They made their own strategic moves looking east.
Absolutely. Russia didn't just survive. They actively worked to secure their future by deepening ties with Asia.
What does that pivot look like in concrete terms?
The key example is the Power of Siberia 2 pipeline agreement with China. This is a huge project.
How much gas are we talking about?
It's set to deliver 50 billion cubic meters of gas annually to China.
50 billion, that's a significant amount.
It is. It gives Moscow a guaranteed, reliable, long-term market for its gas, one that's basically immune to any future European political decisions or sanctions.
Yeah.
So it secures their market regardless of what happens in the West.
Right. And beyond that, some analysts predict that the sheer volume of gas from this pipeline could actually disrupt the global LNG market in the longer run. It might even undermine the value of those very long-term premium contracts that U.S. exporters signed with European buyers, a potential structural shock down the line.
Okay, let's try to pull all these threads together, bringing the analysis full circle. After nearly 4 years, 19 sanctions packages, what's the uncomfortable verdict these sources are presenting?
Well, the verdict seems to be that, based on the evidence presented, the sanctions regime may have inflicted more significant economic pain on the countries imposing them, particularly European industry and consumers, than on Russia itself.
More damage on the sanctioners than the sanction.
That's the argument.
Right.
Russia, it seems, successfully maintained key revenue streams, rerouted its trade flows, and built deeper strategic ties with Asia. Europe, on the other hand, faced deindustrialization pressures and locked itself into costly U.S. energy dependency.
So why did it play out this way, according to these sources?
The conclusion they draw is that this is what happens when governments focus on the quantity of sanctions, the length of the lists, the number of packages, rather than the demonstrated impact on the target's behavior.
Measuring activity rather than outcome.
Exactly. They argue it becomes political theater, not strategic coercion. And that the current approach ultimately ended up serving American commercial goals, and maybe European political signaling needs more than it actually constrained Russia's actions or altered its fundamental course.
That is, yeah, a powerful and pretty unsettling assessment of how things have unfolded. So if the real goal of sanctions should be changing behavior, not just making announcements, what should policymakers actually be tracking? If it's not just the number of sanctions, what are the right metrics to ensure you're getting strategic results, not just symbolic ones?
Is it about tracking trade diversion patterns, capital flight, industrial health at home versus abroad?
Maybe those are the real indicators. Definitely something for you to think about as you follow the headlines this week.